tonight on Arena, remembering Tommy Potts, man and musician, and we preview Marriage, the new BBC series starring Sean Bean and Nicola Walker. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 2022 Dún Laoghaire Folk Festival gets underway in 12 days' time, running from August the 22nd through until September the 11th. The festival has a real international flavour to it, with Irish artists including Christy Moore, joined by American singer-songwriter Cassandra Jenkins, Japanese folk singer Ichiko Aoba, and Moroccan musician and singer Asma Hamzawi, and Banat Timbuktu, which translates as the daughters of Timbuktu. But one of the centrepieces of the festival will be an afternoon in memory of one of the greatest Irish traditional music musicians of all time. I think it's safe to say the legendary Dublin fiddler Tommy Potts. With me in studio this evening is Liam O'Connor, fiddler himself, director of the Irish Traditional Music Archive, who has studied the life and cultural contribution of Tommy Potts and will be at the centre of that celebration on the afternoon of Sunday, September the 4th. Liam, it's almost impossible, I think, in terms of musicians, any fiddler, certainly, I have ever spoken to, the name Tommy Potts will probably come up within one or two questions. Yeah. It'll be the answer to some question that you didn't think was going to involve Tommy Potts. Why was he such an important fiddler in the traditional world?
I think he was the ultimate soloist, you know, so, and the ultimate artist. And I say that within the context of traditional music, you know, there's a large part of the tradition is communal music. But this is someone that didn't occupy that space at all. Stood up in sessions playing, which, you know, which would be going against the grain. He often got emotional playing visibly, but, you know, in terms of the actual sounds and the impact of his music on listeners and on himself. People say he broke boundaries. I would be of the kind, you know, he kind of bent the boundaries into places that you didn't think it would go. Like all great art, it's full of contradictions, I think, you know, that he was born into a family full of traditional music. His dad was an Uilleann Piper.
From Wexford,
living in the Coombe in Dublin, number 6 to Coombe. So it was an area quite rich in traditional music. My own father, according to Google Maps, was 2 minute walk from on Grave Street from number 6 to Coombe. But there were musicians there, but Tommy had that on one hand, but then he had this creative ambition on another. And a bit like a magpie, he would he'd enjoy the Dún Laoghaire folk fest. You know, he could borrow from other traditions.
Yeah, and borrow from places that you mightn't expect, in fact, when it comes down to the bit. He had an interest in... One of the things that helped me learn a bit more about him was this film, which will start off the whole celebration. It's a MacDara Yeats' film, Tommy Potts, the fireman fiddler of the Coombe. And we learn about his life as a fireman as much as we learn about his life as a fiddler. And the two are kind of quite important sides to his life. But one of the things that I noticed with and heard within it was the breadth of his own musical tastes. I think as Paddy Glacken talks about, both opera and classical music has been hugely important to him.
Yeah, and classical music. So violins like Fritz Kreisler, he would hear that played and was quite popular in Tommy's
and Fritz Kreisler was taking kind of tunes and doing this real virtuoso stuff with them, you know, all sorts of variations and double stops and triple stops and effects on the violin.
Yeah, and Tommy wasn't a classically trained violinist, but he could digest parts of... If he heard a composition of Fritz Kreisler on the radio, he might say, OK, if I move that into a different key and into the traditional idiom, would it be a nice prelude to playing a reel composed by a Sligo fiddle player, Martin Wynne, for example? Yeah. So it's one of Fritz Kreisler's pieces, Caprice Finois. It's a Venetian caprice, you know. Yeah. Fritz Kreisler was quite a character too. He composed a lot of tunes and disowned them and hid them. Said he found them in monks' monasteries and all this carry on. And so, but Potts heard that, digested it and made it convincing in his own traditional solo work. So say... And then he goes...
So that's Fritz Kreisler. That'd be the starting part. Point.
So like a prelude, kind of setting a tonal colour. And then... Mm. And even that's only the start of where he'd go with it.
So he takes that Kreiser, and this would be typical of what he did. He took kind of something from somewhere else and then melds it and melts his way into it. We're going to listen to something where he does this.
Yeah.
This is Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms. And again, as he starts this out, it kind of has a kind of parlour, I suppose, classical parlour feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And
he's twisting and bending around, almost Kreisler-like on the fiddle, and then he heads off somewhere else. Yeah. So let's have a listen to Tommy Potts then. That's the great Tommy Potts there with two tunes. First of all, Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms, the air. And as Liam O'Connor, who's with me in studio this evening, was saying, there is that parlour feel, that kind of the Thomas Moore melody aspect to it. But then he goes into a fairly straightforward traditional tune at the end. What's the tune at the very
end? The Rocky Road to Dublin.
But it's what he does in the middle there when he's kind of goes into that little waltz time in between the two. You were saying, what was the influence there?
So he was interviewed by Micheál O'Sullivan, who did his doctorate thesis on it, and thank God he filmed Tommy as well, which was mustn't have been easy to do in the 1970s, you know.
And I believe he was hard to persuade to do anything like that.
Yeah, you couldn't be guaranteed he'd commit to something. So Micheál had won his trust, but he spoke about the Irish classical composer Charles Fitter Stamford.
All right, yeah.
And that introduction, you know, like. Those chords, and then he has the link piece you're talking about. So he has these
unusual twists, because that kind of that I'm calling it is like a drop note, that unusual chord that you get where the note just goes down maybe a tone or a half.
Yeah, he has
a tone.
Kind of a series of fifths running in eight of them. It's almost like a kind of a rave beat now, and then he has syncopation coming in at other points, but all very, I suppose, very convincing. They sit well within the tradition. I think that's the sign of the great artists, you know, that in any walk, like, you know, you'd be at, you know, comparing, say, Picasso with his Dove, you know, anyone could think of it afterwards. And,
when you see it done, it's terribly simple.
Yeah, exactly. That
Let's have a listen to a clip. This is a clip from the film, Tommy speaking. And as you say, very unusual for him to give interviews at all. And Paddy Glacken talked about that in the film as well, about even trying to get him to go into his studio to record something was practically impossible. But here he is speaking about his faith and how important that is to him. And it's followed then by his daughter, Helen O'Shelley, who tells us a little bit about the dynamic in the house at home.
I am emotional. I'm excessively sensitive. Like, praise and thanks be to God. I'm spiritual. I'm a Catholic Christian. And in that, and particularly the last, is for all that I live in fear and nervousness, that I do know a peace, because All that I've said is in his plan for my sanctification.
He was quite enigmatic and he was very passionate, which could at times be hot-tempered. He also had an extremely good sense of humour and a great sense of fun and play. Like, my mother was quite stoic and she read and she was kind and quiet, but my father was the one who'd play jokes on us or hide stuff on us, or he was spontaneous, you know. People who didn't know him well thought he was very strict because he was very, very conscious of being correct always and doing the right things. He wasn't shy in the strictest sense of the word. He wasn't frightened to perform, but he was always very scrupulous that you could be tempted to just dash off something or whatever. And when he played from the heart and he played for the glory of God, basically.
There we go. That's Helen Ichalli at the end of that clip, and beforehand, her father, Tommy Potts, the fiddler. And that's from the film Tommy Potts, the fiddler, the fireman fiddler of the Coombe, which is kicking off this tribute to Tommy Potts September the 4th as part of the Dunluire Folk Festival. That film from McDara Yates and Liam O'Connor, who is one of the contributors to the film. And obviously, we are involved in the festival as well. Liam, with me in studio this evening. That aspect of, I mean, to choose those words for the glory of God, it's a direct echo of Johann Sebastian Bach and what he said about his musical compositions.
Absolutely. So he's a deeply spiritual man. And actually that conversation with Tommy there is taken from a conversation he had with Tony McMahon, one of your former colleagues here. But it's very intense on the spirituality of music, but they had opposite views now on religion, Tony and Tommy. But Tommy, I think, lines with Bach in that regard, but also against the trauma that he experienced as a young 20-year-old, you know, 24, in 1936, when he was involved in this fire accident, that three of his colleagues died in Pear Street. And it was must be a hugely traumatic event for anyone. But for someone who, my sense of it, you know, is that his music carried some deep baggage from there. And it's also, I think, Laz Fallon in the Fire Brigade's historian.
Yeah, he tells a lot of that story, and it's well worth hearing just to hear the whole very sad event and these big funerals of the three firefighters afterwards, almost like state funerals. They had that feeling of him. But I was interested in Tommy Potts saying at the very beginning of that clip, he says, "I'm a very emotional man." Now let's think about the Ireland we're talking about. You know, he was a young man. He was born in 1912. Yeah. So I'm guessing that was probably sometime in the 60s, maybe the 70s. But for a man of his age to talk about emotions, highly unusual, I would have thought.
Yeah, exactly. And to display your emotions, even on the fiddle, you know. So there's legendary anecdotes of say, Tommy Potts playing at Willie Clancy's funeral. And there's floods of tears when he's playing in Friel's pub afterwards, or Queeley's bar. And there's, you know, the music for him wasn't just play an old tune there, you know, it was stand up and play a solo. And it wasn't, you know, some people couldn't hack that either. If people are out for a good night in a communal session, up your bio stuff, it wasn't going to work. And they mightn't enjoy seeing him coming in that context.
And would there have been a bit of an attitude to that? You know, who does he think he is? Would there have been a bit of that going on?
In certain circles. I think over time, now his legacy is you know, people are hanging on his every note. I know that through the Irish Christian Music Archive, if, you know, people come to hear the great artist, and Tommy Potts will forever be His place is secure there.
You mentioned the interview that's within the film as well. We get quite a few clips from this interview with Micheál Osulo. And Micheál Osulo, a very young man in it, as you said, this is part of his doctoral thesis that he was doing. And at the very end of the film, we get, how long was that tape running for? I think the tape had been running for an hour and they couldn't believe that they had that. Yeah. But this is interesting about how Micheál asks him about the tradition that was there when Tommy Potts was starting out and what he liked or disliked about it.
Can you remember first when you started to integrate that kind of music into Irish dance music, or when you started to play the music differently in what we would now call the Tommy Potts style, which nobody else is doing? Is there a particular point in your life, an age, a date, a time, or a reason?
Well, there was when I was Like around that age, and even younger, maybe 17, and in that period, like you know, they used to have Cayleys, you know, and there were Cayley bands, and I played with a few of those. And as quick as I'm saying it, I disliked it. It's a repetitive thing. Playing the first part twice, they're doing the same thing each time, and it's pretty monotonous, no matter how proficiently they do it. And God love them, they don't seem to be bothered with that at all. So, like, this is sort of a difficulty for me is in playing for people. Well, if they're like that, what's the use of me crying and giving?
Tommy Potts stating it very clearly there, Liam O'Connor, about how he felt about the big band or the Cayley band. He clearly wasn't a fan at all.
He's not someone you'd invite to join a Cayley band, or I think even beyond, you know, even his nephew Sean Potts, who played with the Chieftains, of course, and did wonderful, innovative work himself with Paddy Maloney on Two Whistles. And Sean Potts told me a story before that he moved out of home as a teenager and ran away for a little while and went to Uncle Tommy, stayed at home practicing this tune, had wonderful variations worked up, expecting Tommy Potts to love this when he came home. Tommy came home, Sean played him the tune. Don't play it like that, you know. play the correct version. So it's almost it's full of contradictions, I'd say, like great artists, you know. Yeah. But so you'd I think there's one or two recordings I'm playing with other people. There's one actually with Seamus Ennis. Oh. And Tommy Potts, Peter Brown, actually, I've already recorded, and like two giants of the traditional music in Dublin, and great soloists, terrible together, I thought, as, you know, because it's very interesting to hear, but they're such soloists, so far out, and you couldn't really.
Yeah,
the
other thing I wonder about that is, you know, you mentioned about the father, Tommy Potts' father was a piper. Mm. I think his older brother was a champion piper as well.
Eddie
and
Potts, yeah.
It was almost a statement, was it, on the part of Tommy to take up the fiddle that, you know, I'm not going to be a piper here. I'm going to do my own thing.
Yeah, I don't know. There's in that longer interview that Tony McMahon and Paddy Glacken ran with Tommy, he spoke about having breathing difficulties when he was playing the pipes as a kid. And But John Potts was certainly, his dad was a very significant piper. Sadly, we've no recordings of him. We have some of Eddie Potts, his brother, who was a lovely fiddle player and lovely piper and easy company, they say, as well.
Another, I think it's important because it's MacDara Yeats, I think, says it too often. We only know musicians as musicians. We don't know them necessarily as men or as women, you know. And this very much, this is about Tommy Potts, fireman and fiddler. Yeah. And he's very clear, Tommy Potts, and I think it's in another section of that interview with Micheál O'Sullivan about professional versus amateur. He didn't like the idea that he would kind of stand up and play for money. He couldn't think of it in those ways.
No, it's very like a true commitment to art for art's sake. And I don't think you could book him and expect him to turn up with something. Like Michael Turbidy told me a story once that Tommy was asked to play at something Michael was playing, Michael of the Chieftains. And Tommy didn't play. He left. He didn't like there wasn't lighting that or something, and he went home. But equally so, he'd play for people that would call to the house, or good listeners like Paddy Canny down in Clare, Martin Hayes' father, PJ Hayes and Martin. And if he had good listeners, and he got a sense that if he was putting his heart and soul into it, he expected as an artist that the listener is part of that equation. There's not entertainment. There's different between art and entertainment. I think that's what stands out as Tommy as a fiddle player, as a traditional musician. He's an artist more than just a traditional musician.
And communication is a huge part of it, and that whatever happens between the listener and the player was vital.
Exactly. And I think MacDara Yeats in this film has captured that. It's a portrait of an artist, and it's Tommy as a fireman, someone who experienced very significant trauma. And it's given, there's wonderful insights from his daughter as well, and Lars Fallon as well as a historian
of the fire brigade,
and Aoife Ní Bhriain as a contemporary traditional musician and classical violinist.
She does. She plays a lovely tune where she's playing a Bach saraband and suddenly she goes into a Tommy Potts tune in the way a cadenza would allow a player to do that. And it's just her way of paying tribute to him. It's a very, very strong 4 or 5 minutes, but you have to hear the whole piece to get the real sense of it. We'll finish up by listening to Rakesh Patty, and I'll give people full details of all the events and the day that's involved afterwards. Rakesh Patty is from the Liffey Banks, the 1972 album. How important an album is this, you know, in the overall archive of traditional music, which you know all about, Liam?
Yeah, it was seminal, really. You know, it's 50 years since it's released. Paddy Maloney was involved in producing and editing it. He described to me the cutting up the tapes to splice together things. Tommy, I don't think, was too happy with it, which was so great that RTE, 40 years later, brought out another album of Tommy's, which I think is a better portrait in a way of Tommy as an artist. But it is groundbreaking, still absolute, it has to be listened to if you're an interest in traditional music. It's not easy, you know, it requires of the listener. It's not background music.
Well, that's what Tommy Potts wanted, is don't think you can just have me on in the background. You're either listening to me or you're not listening to me, and if you're not listening, I'm not playing.
You might need the dancing shoes for us.
Thanks a million for coming in to us, Liam.
Thank you, Sean.
I'll give those details out in a minute, but let's finish or leave the last notes, as it were, to Tommy Potts and his rendition of Rakesh Patty. Tommy Potts there and his rendition of Rakesh Patty from the 1972 album Liffey Banks. And my thanks to Liam O'Connor, fiddler and director of the Irish Traditional Music Archive. Liam was speaking to us about Tommy Potts, whose life and contribution to Irish music will be celebrated on Sunday, September the 4th, as part of the Dunlera Folk Festival. The festival runs from August 22nd through until September the 11th. Lineup of great Irish and international musicians, Louise Mulcahy, Kevin O'Reilly, Lazarus Soul, Maya Sophia, Varro and many others. You'll get full details of everything happening at the festival on dlfolkfest.ie. You may already have heard the news today that the author and illustrator Raymond Briggs, creator of the much-loved 1978 children's picture book The Snowman, has died at the age of 88. The Snowman has sold more than 5.5 million copies around the world. Briggs also created and enjoyed huge success with children's books Father Christmas and Fungus the Bogeyman. A statement from his family simply said, "We know that Raymond's books were loved by and touched millions of people around the world who will be sad to hear this news." Here's a clip of Briggs where he's asked by a BBC reporter a question about his most famous work.
How do you feel when you're doing Christmas shopping and you hear Alid Jones singing We're Walking in the Air?
Sends me screaming. No.
He's a big fan of this programme, so he'll be watching.
Yes, no, it's perfectly good, of course. I'm riding in the midnight blue. I did an introduction to the Snowman film, and the Americans wanted somebody more important than me to do it, quite rightly, and they somehow got David Bowie to do it.
One winter I met a really big snowman. He got this scarf for me. You see, he was a real snowman.
got it all wrong, of course. He got it terribly wrong.
Did he?
Hopeless. Didn't matter, we did it about six times. But it was fun meeting him, wearing these wonderful glittering pink shoes. Never seen pink shoes before on a man. And he said, oh, I greatly admire your work. And I said, God, wish I could say the same.
But you said that to him?
No, I muttered it.
Wonderful statement there from Raymond Briggs speaking to BBC correspondent Stephen Smith. That's in 2017 about meeting David Bowie, who had voiced the introduction for the Snowman short film in 1982. Raymond Briggs' death was announced today. He was 88. An enduring relationship, indeed an enduring marriage, might not sound like the stuff of television gold, but the BBC is betting on stellar casting and hotshot writing for its new Sunday and Monday night drama, Marriage. Stars Sean Bean, Nicola Walker as a couple who've been married for the guts of 30 years. It depicts the ups and downs of their lives together and puts a very normal long-term relationship under the microscope. Successful years writing award, winning sitcoms like Mum and Him and Her, Stefan Golichevsky says he wanted to move away from comedy to seek a deeper truth. Mary McGill has been looking at Marriage for Arena and she can tell us whether he has succeeded in that or not. This is, a very relatable premise for many, many people, to use the modern parlance, Mary. Very normal couple. And I guess we all know couples like this.
Oh, we do, Sean, looking in the mirror. I think anybody who has been in a long-term relationship or indeed a marriage of any significant length will absolutely respond to these characters, Ian and Emma. And when we meet them first, they are returning from holiday. They're still in the airport and Nicola Walker, playing Emma, walks on screen. She's gotten them some food before their flight. And Ian's a little bit put out, Sean, because she hasn't gotten them a jack of potatoes.
Yeah, well, let's... We have a clip of that. But we have had a long discussion about the price of a sachet of tomato ketchup being 30 yeah. cent, because they're coming they're coming back to England from a holiday somewhere on the European continent. They've come back from Spain, in fact. They've also had a long conversation about whether chips are the right thing to be eating or not. Like, so it's really very, very ordinary dialogue. But the fact that she didn't ask for a jacket potato that he wanted turns into an almighty row between the two of them. Yeah. So let's have a listen to the two of them. I think this is actually on the plane, sitting across the aisle from each other, that they're having this discussion.
Yeah.
We're about to take off.
You ate chips, Ian, so why all the fuss about a jacket potato if you were going to eat the chips anyway?
It'll do it. Power trip.
This isn't about the chips or the flying.
Couldn't you just ask?
We both know what this is about.
You go in there. You're really going to use that.
We've had a lovely holiday.
Wow.
I haven't done anything wrong.
Why was it so hard to ask him to put me a jacket potato? To ask him about the jacket potato. All I wanted was a jacket potato.
I can't believe we're having an argument about jacket potatoes.
Seriously. Jacket potatoes.
You keep going on about jacket potatoes, so.
If you'd have wanted me to ask, I'd have asked.
You know, rows have been had about smaller things than jacket potatoes. But I guess, Mary, that's a scene from Marriage. Sean Bean and Nicola Walker there as Ian and Emma, the married couple who are very much at the centre of this story. But I guess, as she says at one point in that clip, this isn't about the jacket potato. It's never about the jacket potato, let's face it. And that's what this series struck me. It's not what's been said that's important. It's what's not been said.
What is not been said hangs heavy in the gestures and the silence and the kind of quietness that comes with this show. It's very, very distinctive for its lack of dialogue. But still, Ian and Emma, and when I saw Sean Bean and Nicola Walker attached to this, Sean, I said, we're in safe hands here because these are two actors who know exactly what they're doing. And they imbue Ian and Emma with this real depth of humanity. So yes, just as you say, they're having to throw about a jacket potato, but it's actually not about a jacket potato at all. Ian is going through a very difficult time. He's recently been made redundant. He's recently lost his mother to cancer, and he's lost his sense of himself in the world. He's still that big kind of bear of a man that we associate with a lot of characters that Sean Bean plays. But there is this real tender vulnerability that he is grappling with, and he's relying on Emma in a way to kind of like, there's lots of scenes of them where they're hugging, and so often those scenes, although she's much smaller than him physically, you can get a sense that she's holding him up effectively.
Yeah, and so she's got quite a busy life outside of the home as well. She has a big career. She's a solicitor, so at least she's working with a firm of solicitors.
Yes, she is. And both of them, and Emma, this is true of as well, you know, they're facing into issues that really crop up and intensify in midlife. So she's got ambitions for her career in the legal profession. And she's also got, you know, more financial concerns now that Ian isn't working. Mm. But spending more time in the office means spending more time with her slimy boss. And she also has caring duties outside of the home.
Yeah.
With her father, who for some reason is not particularly taken with her and is quite cruel towards her. And Ian is a source of comfort for her there as well.
Yeah, I'll come back to the father relationship in a moment, because it's quite an interesting family dynamic. But the dynamic at work is interesting, given, as you said, the Sean Bean character has been made redundant. He's also dealing with the death of his mother. She goes back to work after the holidays, and there is the wonderful Jamie, her boss, played by Henry Lloyd Hughes, and this is his greeting to her.
Morning, Jamie. Sorry I'm late.
Oh, new jacket?
Yes, yeah.
Cool. Did you get that on holiday?
Yeah. Well, I ordered it on a holiday, and then it was there when I got back.
Cool. Good holiday, bad holiday, glad to be home.
Good, yes, thank you.
Is it Spain?
Yes, yeah.
Take a seat. Where's it from?
I just got it online.
It's a great colour.
Thanks.
Yeah, you never know when you buy online whether it's...
It's a bit of a gamble.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I love that colour on you.
Thank you.
How's Ian? Do you mind if I eat?
Of course, yes, yeah. Go ahead.
I had to grab this on the way in, had a bit of a night last night.
No, Ian was good. Thank
you. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Bet that was a relief.
Well, he needed a bit of a holiday, so...
Well, his whole life's a holiday now. You're not allowed to go away again.
Yeah.
Seriously, I'm not even joking. Honestly, those two...
That's Henry Lloyd Hughes as Jamie, the boss of Emma, played by Nicola Walker in the new BBC series Marriage, which is coming to our screens towards the end of next week, or the beginning of next week. Mary McGill has been watching it for us. And again, even within that's as dialogue heavy as it gets, really and truly, Mary. But even within that, you see those pauses that are left. You think, what is he going to say here? The writing is very clever in how it has us thinking along the way as to what is or isn't going on.
Absolutely. And I'm cringing listening to this. And I think it's the silence more than anything. Mm. The pacing that really, the awkwardness comes across there. And that symbol as well of that red jacket that he's complimenting. Like we see, Emma kind of leaving the house and then coming back to collect the red jacket and then put it on again. No dialogue, but we get a sense that she's putting on the red jacket because she thinks that Jamie might like it. Or perhaps not. But, you know, there's something going on. You know, the fact that she's been flattered, there is something going on there. And that is so subtle, and it's so beautifully done, and it's telling us. I mean, this is a masterwork in showing, not telling, Sean, right? Those little details that just reveal so much about the character that actually, you know, the kind of the lack of dialogue, it just goes to show you how redundant dialogue can be, that there's so much you can do on screen to tell a story. I mean, you mentioned The Snowman and Raymond Briggs earlier on, and I was just thinking it's exactly that. It's the observation and the storytelling and the understanding of human behaviour, and that really is what Marriage runs on.
And if I had to describe the style, it's almost got that documentary feel to it, you know, fly on the wall documentary, where there's a scene where you're watching the two of them put the stuff into the dishwasher. That's all that's happening.
Yes.
Now, does it hold? Is there enough tension? Because that's asking a lot of the audience. And it does move quite slowly. Little snippets of information are thrown our way at certain times. But it takes a long time to get to know the family dynamic. They have a daughter, and as you mentioned, this caregiving situation that Emma's involved in. does it ask a lot of the viewer?
You have to pay attention. That's certainly true. This is not one to watch while you're scrolling through your phone or being distracted. This demands your attention, but it also kind of expects it. You know, in an age now where there are so many distractions, it is worth paying attention to the subtleties of something as good as marriage. I mean, I think it's interesting what you say there about how real it feels. I was watching it and I was feeling this is reality TV. Like, yeah, this feels more real than so much of the entertainment that's out there now. It really feels like this is a kind of a perfectly realised window into a long-term relationship and all the kind of nuances and tensions that come with that.
And
you believe it, Sean. There's real depth to this. You believe these characters in these situations. They're so real to you.
I spoke about the family dynamic. They have a daughter. We know that there's something else in their early marriage that I don't want to say, but that becomes a big issue that it has to be revealed to us along the way. But it's her, Emma's father and brother, the brother who scarpers up the stairs the minute she appears at the door. We don't know why, but I'm sure we're going to find that out. But here she is arriving back to her father, played by James Bullum, and she's just telling him about her holiday. And you might think that he'd be interested. Let's see how he responds to her on her return from holiday.
A lot of the food was quite oily.
Ooh.
Yeah. But we found some normal places. We went in the sea. We mainly stayed by the pool and read, but yeah. Nice to be in the sea.
Cold?
You get used to it. How you been? You been okay? Dad? You been able to get out much? Has Paul taken you anywhere? Dad.
How can you honestly ask me if I've had a good time when it was you who abandoned me?
Talk about knowing how to pour on the guilt. That's James Bollum playing the father of Emma, the character played by Nicola Walker in Marriage. And that's after she comes back from a two-week holiday. And remember, her mother-in-law has died and her husband has been made redundant in the previous few weeks. None of that is up for discussion.
Absolutely not.
And again, down to the quality of the acting here, we could hear the clock ticking in the background, but there's a lot of that where you're watching them do nothing, in inverted commas. Could it survive without the acting talent that's there?
I don't think that it could, Sean. I mean, like, it's amazing. We heard silences there. Those silences were not empty. They were dripping with passive aggressiveness, you know, and we can hear it in Nicola Walker's voice and Emma's voice as she responds progressively. Kind of the pitch is going up and she's trying to fill the silence and it's just not working. And her father remains monotone, cold, removed. All of that work done through silence. And I'm amazed actually hearing the audio, how well it works on radio as well. That's tricky.
Yeah.
So it really says something about the writing and the acting.
Yeah. And what was I going to say? The daughter character in it as well, that family dynamic. Again, I don't want to give too much away here, but we get the impression that the daughter who's gigging around the place, she's in trouble in her relationship.
She is. She's got a new boyfriend, Sean, and he's really into her, but not necessarily in a good way. And there's kind of a comedy to that element of it because he really wants to marry her. And that's not giving too much away, but it does. There's kind of a full circleness to that as well. You know, so these young people starting out down this path and a lot of alarm bells are going off. This guy is not particularly nice. The daughter's name is Jess. And so, yes, it's an interesting look at younger people's kind of heading in that direction and what it could potentially mean. And of course, Ian and Emma are looking at this as now parents, right? And
this is very, very different. So I've seen two episodes and I can't wait to see the rest of it. How much have you seen, Mary? And will you be tuning in?
You know, I've seen two as well, Sean, and I cannot wait to see the rest of it. I think it's masterfully done. Nicola Walker, I think, is one of the best actresses at work today. Whenever I see her name attached to something, yeah. I'm going to watch that. And in terms of quality control, she's amazing. So, yeah, I think that this is going to be one of those shows that people are going to be talking about. It's going to be repeated. And dare I say it, I think for Stefan Goluchevsky, there's going to be even more BAFTAs on the way. Yeah. So, yes, I'll definitely be watching.
I hope there's more than just for the four episodes, but we'll have to wait and see. Mary, thanks for sharing your thoughts on Marriage with us this evening. That's Marriage the television series rather than Marriage the State of Being. Marriage begins on BBC One this Sunday at 9 p.m, followed by episode two, on Monday the 15th of August, again at 9 p.m, and the final two episodes will be on Sunday the 21st of August, 9 p.m, Monday the 22nd of August, 9 p.m. In recent years, artist Kevin Atherton has become known for re-entering his previous works and through these interventions adds to or alters their previous meaning. In a new exhibition at the Butler Gallery in Kilkenny, the time gap between the first work and the second work varies from 43 years to a few minutes in different cases. These works tackle issues such as identity, use humour to question the notion of the artist's documentary while simultaneously challenging television codes and practices. Delighted to be joined by Kevin Atherton on the programme this evening. And I mentioned television in my introduction there, Kevin. I was interested to see an interview that you gave, or it was a little short statement that you were making about around your own interest in television and television as a kind of a spring off point for some of your works. Why is television so important to you, and what does it tell us about what you want to achieve with what you're doing?
Well, in a way, I think it speaks for my generation. I'm 71 and I can remember the coming of television, if you like. And I think we were possibly the first family in the street to have TV around about 1957. This was in the Isle of Man. And I've worked as a fine artist since I went to art school, but I belong to a generation of what have now become regarded as pioneering video artists who used the emergence of video art as a means to deconstruct television, if you like. But an example of it, if that sounds too sort of intellectual, in 1984, I made a two-monitor video installation where I interviewed the cast of Coronation Street, and by manipulating the sound, it appeared as if I was having a conversation with the cast. So at one point I say, rather in a frustrated way, I say, "Has anybody there ever heard of Marcel Duchamp?" And Jack Duckworth says, not according to me. So there's this sort of meeting of popular culture with fine art, which has been a theme throughout all of the things that I've done. And you mentioned works that I've re-entered at the Butler Gallery. One work is called Boxing Rematch. And, you know, being a kid in the 60s, we were allowed to stay up late if Cassius Clay, as he was then, the wonderful Muhammad Ali, was fighting. And boxing was a much bigger part of the culture then. And I made a film in 1972 where, against a white background, I box no one. I kind of shadow box. And I'm dressed in nice yellow shorts and I have boxing gloves and boxing boots on. And I'm boxing no one, in effect, but I'm taking the punches. I'm pretending to being hit. And then live, I boxed with my projected self. And that's one of the works that I've got out of the attic, if you like. But now, as a 71-year-old man, I box with my younger self. And whereas in the beginning, the work might have been about questioning the reality of film as opposed to real time, etc. Now, if you were coming away and you were thinking only of those formal concerns, you're missing the point of this is an old man battling with his younger self.
Yeah.
What kind of accessibility and humour is a theme throughout all of my work?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to pick up on, particularly is this idea of accessibility, because that was something that you said in that short interview that I saw earlier today that really stuck with me. And part of the reason that you used television and popular culture, or that you continue to use television and popular culture in your works, is this idea of accessibility. And I noticed how quick you were to say, look, if that sounds too highfalutin and intellectual, let me give you a specific example.
Yes.
How big a challenge is that when you're dealing with, you know, difficult and interesting conceptual ideas, but that you don't want it to be so interesting and conceptual that nobody understands what's going on except you? What size of challenge is that?
Well, I think the medium helps. People have a familiarity with television. They're not intimidated by television in the way that they might be by the gallery or by sort of more conventional fine art forms. So once you get that first engagement, I think, once you get that first hook, I mean, the work isn't just about gags or just jokes, but it that's a way of getting people in. For me, humour just means human. And if the work is referencing television codes or the way that people view television, then a mass audience are very sophisticated, particularly now with digital TV and, you know, they're very familiar with the grammar of watching on a screen. So the work plays around with that. And I like to think the work is layered. You don't have to get everything, but you get something.
Yes. And
it's playful. The work is playful.
And that idea of, I mean, you touched on it, that yes, at one level, you're questioning about, you know, the truth of what you're seeing on screen. That is part of the questioning. So in fact, in some ways, you were doing fake interviews, if you like, and doing fake boxing matches long before we heard what fake news was, or before that phrase became so popular to us. But was only a small part of what you really wanted to investigate.
Well, yes, and to talk about truth, what to believe, and this, of course, was, you know, I was doing this back in the 70s, along with, you know, other artists who belonged to that generation of video and performance artists in the 1970s. But it was also about, in a broader sense, questioning. And it was before reality television, this whole thing about reality and broadcast and the codes. I mean, people are very literate when it comes to media, and perhaps not so much with painting and sculpture, although there are some objects in the exhibition. There's a work, there's a bronze maquette of a piece that I did on Brixton Railway Station back in 1986, I placed three bronze figures on Brixton Railway Station, three life-size bronze figures who have been on Brixton Station for 36 years now, and the trains pass between them. And recently, because one of the platforms has become defunct, I've had to move one of the bronzes to another platform. And I've found the model who, back in 1986, was 26 years of age. Now she's 61, and I've recast her. So the piece is called Double Joy, because the model's name was Joy Batic, and she's on two platforms, and the trains will pass between her, between the two of them. So this re-entering thing doesn't always just involve me. Yeah. It extends to other people who've been involved in the work.
And again, I think from what you're describing in that piece, in some ways, and indeed the piece you described in the boxing rematch, by looking back at it, it gives us a sense that whatever you did in the initial pieces, those initial pieces, was true at that moment in time. But to kind of think that you can fix that and say, there you go, like a statue sitting on a plinth, that's it. Yes. It's forever and amen. That is the truth. It seems to suggest to me that the truth only exists for the split moment or the split whatever short period of time when a work of art is finished. After that, the truth can kind of disappear.
It can disappear, sure, but it can change. The truth, as you call it, changes. And I like to be involved in, or I like that, to think that the works recognise those changes. Yeah. And play around with them. I mean, this show at the Bulletin, it's very satisfying to see so much of the work together, because learning viewing one work in a way helps you view the next work, that they all interconnect and lead you through the exhibition.
There's a piece on a television set that I only saw a short section of in Kilkenny, and I think it's you. I'm not sure if it was your voice that was guiding me through it, where you're drawing. There are drawings happening on the page, and then you're rubbing some of the drawings out and changing them and reworking them. Tell me a little bit more about that piece.
Well, that was a proposal for Newcastle. And that was over 20 years ago. And I submitted the proposal as a drawing to make a sculpture. And the sculpture would have been a tower of bronze scaffolders frozen in the act of handing the scaffolding poles to one another. So the drawing is of about 9 bronze figures holding steel scaffolding poles. And the truth is, I never got the commission, but I really liked the drawing. So after 20 years, I did a video of it, and it appears as if I'm rubbing out the sculpture. Mm. And the story that I'm telling, the narration is that Newcastle County Council now want me to take the sculpture down, and that was the original deal. But it's pitched at a level where it's actually, because I give the backstory, this thing, you know, when I showed that piece in the Isle of Man in the Manx Museum, the invigilators were emailing me saying they'd been looking online to see if it existed in Newcastle upon Tyne. And it was then that I knew that the spoofing that I was doing was working. And that kind of, as you said at the beginning, it's a way of questioning truth, or the truth as it's represented through television and indeed radio.
Finally, Kevin, a very interesting conversation. Thank you for it. But when we hear looking back, we often think that there's nostalgia involved in doing so. Is it a nostalgic event for you, or is it something else, some other emotion?
I think of course, there's a nostalgic aspect to it, but I think it's more revealing. I think it sufficiently re-enters the work. It gives it a whole new set of meanings that are to do with where I am now, but where we all are now.
Well, Kevin, it has been really interesting to speak with you, and thanks so much for sharing your ideas with us this evening on Arena. That's Kevin Atherton. Thanks, Kevin. Kevin Atherton there. And The Return will be at the Butler Gallery in Kilkenny through until October, obviously linking in with the Kilkenny Arts Festival. And you find out full details on kilkennyarts.ie. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.